as a nurse forever, arranging wrists in a pleasing pattern above starched bedsheets, reading the nonsense words of scripture that seemed to help so. She could manage the dying. Then, a year ago, pale invalid Tibbet was carted to the home for the incurables. He wasn't too far gone to recognize her, even behind her veil and silences. Weak, unable to shit or piss without help, his skin falling in rags and parchment, he was better at life than she was. He selfishly required that she be an individual, and he addressed her by her name. He joked. He remembered stories. He criticized old friends for abandoning him. He noticed the differences in how she moved from day to day, how she thought. He reminded her that she did think. Under the scrutiny of his tired frame, she was recreated, against her will, as an individual, or nearly. At last he died, and the Superior Mont had said that it was time for her to go and atone for her mistakes, though not even the Superior Mont knew what they were. When that was done, well, she was still a young woman. She could raise a family. Take her broom and remember, obedience and mystery. "You can't sleep," said Otsi one night, as Elfie sat under the stars. But though her thoughts were rich and complicated, her words were poor, and she merely grunted. Otsi made a few jokes at which Elfie tried to smile, but Otsi laughed enough for both of them, big, full laughs. It made Elfie tired.
"Isn't that cook a piece of work?" said Otsi,
and told some episode that seemed pointless, and she chortled at her own story. Elfie tried to enjoy, tried to grin, but above her the stars grew thicker, more like glittering fish spawn than salt. They turned on their stalks with a cursing, grinding sound, if only she could hear it. She couldn't hear it. Otsi was too coarse and loud. There was much to hate in this world, and too much to love. Before long they came to the edge of Kell's Water, a murderous slice of water lying as if cleft from the side of a thundercloud. It was all grey, no lights on it.
"That," said Otsi, "is why the horses don't drink from it, nor travellers. That's why it was never tapped in aqueducts and run to the Emerald City. It's dead water. And you thought you'd seen it all."
Still, the travellers were impressed. A lavender heaviness arose on its western edge, the first hint of the great Kells, the mountains that separated the Vincas from the rest of Oz. From here the mountains appeared as thin as gas. Otsi demonstrated the use of the fog charm in the event of an attack by a band of Unimata hunters.
"Are we going to be attacked?" asked the boy, who seemed to be Elfie's page. "I'll get him dead before no one knows what's on."
The fear rose up from him and caught on in the others.
"We usually do well," said Otsi. "We just need to be prepared. They can be friends, if we are friends."
The caravan straggled by day, four wagons keeping their distance, accompanied by 9 horses, 2 cows, a bull, a heifer, and various chickens, without much personality. The cook had a dog named Killyjoy, who seemed to Elfie a Makejoy instead, a panting, sniffy thing. Some people thought for a time he might actually be a dog in hiding, but they gave up that idea.
"Ha!" Elfie said to the others. "Have you spoken to animals so seldom that you can't remember the difference any more?"
No, he was just a dog, but a most glorious doggy dog, full of rages and exaggerated devotions. Killyjoy was a mountain breed, part Leinster Collie, part Lenx Terrier, and maybe part wolf.
His nose went up like a butter curl in gray-black ridges and ribs. He could not be kept from hunting, but he did not catch much either. By night, when the wagon squared off together, the cooking fire within, the animals just nearby without, and the singing began at last, Killyjoy hid under the wagon. Otsi heard the boy tell the dog his name.
"I'm Lear," said the boy. "You can be my dog, sort of."
She had to smile. The fat child was not good at making friends, and a lonely child should have a dog. Kelswater slipped back out of sight. Some felt safer away from it. Almost hourly the great Kells rose and thickened, the color now like the brown rind of a butterdew melon. Still the track meandered along the valley, the Vincus River on its right, the mountains beyond it. Otsi knew several places to ford, but they weren't clearly marked. While they searched, Killyjoy caught a valley grite at last. He bled and whined and was treated for poison. Lear let him ride in his arms, which made Elfie faintly jealous. She was almost amused to note in herself such a turgid, old-fashioned feeling as jealousy. The cook was angry that Killyjoy preferred someone else's company more than his. He shook his ladle overhead as if summoning the wrath of angel chefs among the stars. Elfie thought of him as a butcher cook, as he seemed to have no scruples about shooting rabbits and eating them. "How do you know they're not rabbits?" she said, and she wouldn't touch a bite. "Quiet, you, or I'll cook that little boy instead," he answered. She tried to raise with Otsi the notion of firing the cook, but Otsi would not listen. "We're coming into Cambricia's Pass," she said. "My mind is on other matters." They couldn't help but feel the unsettling eroticism of the landscape. From the eastern approach, the Cambricia Pass looked like a woman lying on her back, her legs spread apart, welcoming them. Up in the slopes, the pine boughs shaded the sun. The wild pears tangled their twisted branches together as if wrestling. A sudden dampness, a new private climate. The bark ran wet, the air sank heavily against the skin like half-laundered toweling. Once inside the forest, the travelers could not see the hills. Everything smelled of ferns and fiddle greens. And on the shores of a small lake stood a dead tree. It harbored a community of bees at their work of chamber music and honey.
"I want to take them with us," said Elfie. "I'll talk to them and see if they'll come."
There had been bees in the kitchen garden at Craig Hall, and again at the cloister of St. Glinda in the Shale Shallows. Elfie was entranced by them. But Lear was terrified, and the cook threatened to disappear and leave the group traumatized by an inability to do a really top-notch bechamel sauce in the wilderness. Discussion was waged. An old man in the party, heading westward to die because of some midnight vision, ventured as to how a little honey would improve the tasteless sparrow-leaf tea. A Glickan mail-order bride agreed. Otsi, of sentimental enthusiasms, when least expected, voted for honey. So Elfie climbed the tree and talked to the bees, and they came along in a swarm, but most travelers stayed in the other wagons, suddenly scared of every fleck of dust that flitted against the skin. They sent out a request, using drums and mist, to attract the attention of a hired Rafiki, for caravans were not allowed to move through the lands of different Vincas tribes without a guide to negotiate permissions and fees. Bored one evening, and responding to the gloom, the travelers fell to discussing the legend of the Cumbric Witch. Who comes first, the Fairy Queen Lurline or the Cumbric Witch? Igo, the sick old man, quoted the Ossiad, and reminded them all of how creation worked. The dragon of time created the sun and the moon, and Lurline cursed them and said that their children wouldn't know their own parents. And then the Cumbric witch came along, and the flood, the battle, the spilling of evil in the world. Otsi Mangalhan disagreed. She said, "You old fools! The Ossiad is just a frilly romantic poem of older, harsher legends. What lives in folk memory is truer than how some artsy poet says it. In folk memory, evil always predates good." "Can this be true?" asked Igo with interest. "Surely there is the handful of nursery märchen that start, 'Once in the middle of a forest lived an old witch,' or 'The devil was out walking one day and met a child,'" said Otsi, who was showing that she had some education as well as grit. "To the grim poor there need be no pourquoi tale about where evil arises. It just arises. It always is. One never learns how the witch became wicked, or whether that was the right choice for her. Is it ever the right choice? Does the devil ever struggle to be good again? Or, if so, is he not a devil? It is at the very least a question of definitions." "It certainly is true that tales of the Cumbric witch abound," agreed Igo. "Every other witch is just a shadow, a daughter, a sister, a decadent descendant. The Cumbric witch is the model further back than which it seems impossible to go." Elfi remembered the ambiguous scroll painting of the Cumbric witch. Was it she? Found in the library of Three Queens that summer long ago, standing in shiny shoes, straddling a continent, nursing or choking a beast. "I don't believe in the Cumbric witch, even in Cumbricia's pass," boasted the cook. "You don't believe in rabbits either," snarled Elfi, suddenly annoyed. "The question is, does the Cumbric witch believe in you?" "Temper," sang out Otsi, and turned it into a sing-along song. Elfi stamped away. This was too much like her childhood, discussions with her father and Nessa Rose about where evil begins. As if one could ever know. Her father used to orchestrate proofs about evil as a way of persuading his flock to convert. Elfi had come to think, back in Shiz, that as women wore cologne, men wore proofs to secure their own sense of themselves and thus to be attractive. But surely evil was beyond proof, just as the Cumbric witch was beyond the grasp of knowable history. The Rafiki arrived, a thin, balding man with battle scars. There might be trouble from the Unamata this year, he told them.
"The caravan comes after a season of dirty forays by cavalry from the Emerald City. Winky roundup," he complained. It wasn't clear if he was talking about a local argument over a drunken slight to a Vincus maiden, or about a slave trade and resettlement camps. The camp was broken, the lake left behind, and the silent forest continued for a half a day. Sunlight speared through the canopy from time to time, but it was a thin egg yolk light, and seemed always to be off to the side, never spotlighting down on the path ahead. It was eerie, as if Cumbricia herself were moving along beside them, hidden, unbidden, passing from tree to tree, sliding behind rocks, waiting in shadowy depths, watching and listening. The ailing old man wailed nasally and prayed to emerge from this mystery wood before he died, or his spirit might never find its way out. The boy wept like a girl. The cook wrung the neck of a chicken. Even the bees stopped humming. In the middle of the night, the cook disappeared.
There was consternation among all except Elfie, who didn't care. Was it a kidnapping, or a sleepwalking episode, or a suicide? Were the angry Unimata near and watching? Was it Cambricia herself taking revenge on them for discussing her so glibly? There were many opinions, and the breakfast eggs were runny and inedible. Killyjoy did not notice the cook's disappearance. He snuggled, grinning in his coma sleep, closer to Lear. The bees went into some sort of mysterious hibernation inside the joint of tree trunk brought along to make them happy. Killyjoy, still smarting from grite poison, slept 22 hours a day. The travelers, afraid of being overheard, stopped talking altogether. Toward the evening the pines at last began to thin, and the forest to shift to staghead oak, which with its broader branches let in more of the sky. A pasty yellow sky, but at last a sky, and then there was a cliff edge. They had climbed higher than anyone had quite realized. Beneath and beyond stretched the rest of Cambricia's pass, a journey of 4 or 5 days. Beyond that was the beginning of the 1,000-year grasslands. No one was sorry for the light and room that the sky afforded. Even Elfie felt her heart lift unexpectedly. In the middle of the night, the Unimata arrived. They brought gifts of dried fruit and sang tribal songs and made those who would dance get up and dance. The travelers were more terrified of their hospitality than of the attack that they had expected. As Elfie thought about it, the Unimata seemed soft, compliant folk, only as fearful and fearless as schoolgirls. At least that was all they showed. They were cavorting, opinionated. They reminded her of the Quadlings with whom she had grown up. Perhaps ethnically they were distant cousins. Long lashes, narrow elbows, baby-like supple wrists, oblong heads and thin, concentrated lips. Even with their foreign tongue they made her feel at home. The Unimata left in the morning, complaining rudely about the runniness of the breakfast eggs. The Rafiki said that the Unimata would make no further trouble. Even he seemed disappointed, as if his employment hadn't been required. There was no word about the cook. The Unimata didn't seem to know anything about him. As the caravan continued its descent, the sky opened up again, brisk and autumnal, wide as remorse. From there to there, the eye could hardly take it in. The plain below, compared to the mountains, seemed level as a lake. The wind made strokes across it, as if spelling things in a language of curls and stripes. No wildlife was visible from this distance, though there were tribal fires here and there. Cambricia's pass was left behind, or nearly. Then a Unimata messenger came on swift leathery feet, arriving from the pass behind them, to share the news that a body had been found at the base of a cliff. Perhaps it was the cook. It was thought to be a man, but the surface of the corpse was so swollen with lesions that the particulars were lost. "It was the bees," said someone, full of rage. "Oh, was it?" came Elfie's calm voice. "They've been asleep for so long. Wouldn't there have been screams if they'd attacked a man in the middle of the night? Did the bees sting his throat first, to swell his vocal cords shut? Very talented bees, those." "It was the bees," was the mutter. And the implication was clear. "You too." "Oh, I forgot the size of the human imagination," Elfie said meanly. "How very large it is, after all." But she wasn't upset, not really.
for Killyjoy was back to himself at last, and the bees woke up, too. Perhaps the high altitudes at the top of the Cambrisia Pass had given them such sleep. Elfie began to prefer their company to the rest of the travelers. As they woke up, coming down from the heights, she felt herself more and more awake, too. The Rafiki pointed out on the horizon several mounding coils of smoke. At first, the travelers guessed they were windstorms, but Otsi soothed them and alarmed them. It was evening fires for a large encampment, Skro. It was autumn hunting season, though nothing had been seen of any game bigger than a hare or a grass fox. Its brush, a wild swipe of bronze on melting golden meadow. Its feet in black stockings, like a serving maid's. Killyjoy was ecstatic with the possibilities of encounter. He could hardly bear to rest at night. Even in his dreams, he twitched with the hunt. The travelers feared the Skro more than they had the Unimata. The Rafiki did not say much to allay their fears. He was more tentative than it at first seemed. Perhaps the job of negotiating among suspicious peoples required caution. Lear idolized him hopelessly after only a few days of travel. Elfie thought, such silly things, children, and so embarrassing, because they keep changing themselves out of shame, out of a need to be loved or something, while animals are born who they are, accept it, and that is that. They live with greater peace than people do. She felt in herself a jolt of pleasurable expectation over the thought of approaching the Skro. Along with so much else, she had forgotten what pleasurable expectation was. As night fell, everyone seemed more alert, out of fear and excitement. The skies throbbed with turquoise even at midnight. Starlight and comet tails burned the tips of endless grass below into a hammered silver. Like thousands of tapers in the chapel, just blown out but still glowing. If one could drown in the grass, thought Elfie, it might be the best way to die. It was noon when the caravan pulled up to the edge of the Skro camp. A committee of Skro had ridden to their domestic margin, where the sand-colored tents petered out into untrampled grass. Men and women alike sat on horseback, about 7 or 8 of them, in blue ribbons and ivory bangles. Also, obviously senior, was a huge slab of an old woman, carried on a palanquin of some sort, its frame all hung round with tambours and clinking amulets and gauzy veils. She let the Rafiki and the tribal paladins trade compliments or insults. After a while she grunted a direction, and her curtains were withdrawn so she could see. She had an overhung lip so large that it doubled back on itself like an upside-down spout on a pitcher. Her eyes were ringed with coal. On her shoulders sat 2 dyspeptic-looking crows. Their feet were shackled in gold links and attached to loops in her ornamental collar, into which the old woman had dribbled traces of the fruit she had been eating as she waited. Her shoulders were speckled with crow droppings.
"The Princess Nastoya," said the Rafiki at last.
She was the filthiest, least educated princess anyone had ever seen. Yet she had some dignity. Even the most ardent democrat among the travelers genuflected. She laughed raucously. Then she bade her bearers lug her away to some place less tedious. The Skro camp was arranged in concentric circles, with the princess's tent in the middle, prettied up with extensions of faded, striped baldachins on all sides. It was a little airy palace in silks and cotton muslin. Her advisers and concubine husbands seemed to live in the nearest circle. And a scrawny lot the husbands were, thought Elfie. But perhaps they were chosen for timidity and scrawniness, to make her seem ever the larger. Beyond the princess's settlement ranged 400 tents, which meant maybe 1,000 people altogether. 1,000 humans, with their poached salmon skin, their moistly protruding eyes, but sensitive in lowered gazes to avoid being met, their handsome, generous noses and big buttocks and wide, rolling hips, men and women alike. Most of the caravan travelers stayed glued to the doors of their wagons, imagining crime just beyond the nearest tent. But Elfie found it impossible to keep still with all this newness beckoning. When Elfie walked, there were gasps, and the adults shyly retreated out of her path. But only 10 minutes had passed before there were 60 children in a noisy crowd following behind, running ahead like a cloud of midges. The Rafiki advised caution, advised return to the camp, but childhood in the Quadling Badlands had made Elphaba not only bold, but curious. There were more ways to live than the ones given by one's superiors. After the evening meal, a delegation of erect old Scrode dignitaries approached the grass-trail train and entered into a lengthy palaver with the Rafiki. In the end, the Rafiki translated the message. A small band was invited, requested, ordered, to the Scrow shrine. It would take an hour by camel. For her sin of skin color, presumably, or possibly for having had the nerve to take a solitary stroll through the Scrow tent city, Elfie was to join Otsi, the Rafiki, Igo for his venerable age, and one of the financial adventurers named Pinchweed, or maybe that was just a nasty nickname. By the light of sallowwood torches, the camels in glittering caparisons lurched and lumbered on a worn track. It was like going up and down a staircase at the same time. Elfie sat above the grass, a vantage point over the great flickering surface. Although the ocean was only an idea sprung out of mythology, she could almost see where it came from. There were small grasshawks launching themselves like fish, leaping out of the spume, nipping at the fireflies, pocketing them, then falling back in a dry splash. Bats passed, making a guttering, sputtering sound that ended in an extinguishing swoop. The plain itself seemed to bring forth night color, now a heliotrope, now a bronzy green, now a dun color skeined through with red and silver. The moon rose, an opalescent goddess tipping light from her harsh maternal scimitar. Nothing more need have happened. It seemed enough to Elphaba to find herself capable of such a weird, ecstatic response to soft color and safe space. But no, on, on. Eventually, Elfie noticed a plantation of trees, carefully tended in this devastating openness. First a stand of scrub spruce, contorted by the winds into gnarled figures of split bark and hissing needles, and the pagan odor of sap. Beyond, a rise of higher hedges, then yet higher trees. It was the circular pattern of the Scrow encampment again. The party passed into it in silence, as through a maze, along curving corridors of whispering brush, moving from outer to inner circles, lit by oil lamps hammered to carven posts. Within, at the center, was the Princess Nastoya, girded in a native costume of leather and grass, made all the more effective by a length of striped purple and white toweling she must have bargained from some traveller or other. She stood distracted and breathing heavily, leaning on stout walking sticks. Around her, sarsen stones like gapped teeth resembled a stone cage through which she could hardly pass, given her bulk. The guests joined the hosts in eating, drinking, and smoking on a pipe with a bowl carved like a crow's head. Crows ranged all around, on the tops of the sarsens, 20, 30, 40. Elfie's head spun. The moon rose, the plain at night, invisible from the secret garden of the green maze, wheeled about like a child's top. She could almost hear the spinning. The Scrow elders chanted in a drone. When the drone died out, the Princess Nastoya raised her head. The huge wattles of old flesh beneath her small chin wobbled. Her toweling fell to the ground. She was naked and old and strong. What had seemed like boredom was revealed as patience, memory, control. She shook the very hair off her head, and it uncoiled down her back and disappeared. Her feet moved massively, as if seeking the best purchase, like columns, like pillars of stone. She dropped her arms forward, and her back was a dome. Still her head was up, her eyes the brighter, her nose working mightily. She was an elephant. An elephant goddess, Elfie thought, her mind recoiling in terror and delight. But the Princess Nastoya said, "No." She spoke through the Rafiki still. He had obviously seen this before, though with the alcohol he stuttered and had to search for words. One by one she asked the intentions of the travellers. "Money and commerce," said Pinchweed, shocked into honesty. "Money and commerce and pillage and plunder, at whatever cost. A place to die where I can rest, and my spirit go abroad," ventured Igo. "Safety and movement out of harm's way," said Otzi spunkily, by which it was clear she meant out of men's way. The Rafiki indicated that Elfie's own answer was still needed. In the presence of such an animal, Elfie could not stay aloof. So she spoke it as best as she could. "To retire from the world after making sure of the safety of the survivors of my lover. To face his widow, Sarima, in guilt and responsibility. And then to remove myself from the darkening world." The elephant told the others, except the Rafiki, to leave. The elephant raised her trunk and sniffed the wind. Her roomy old eyes blinked slowly, and her ears moved back and forth, raking the air for nuance. She pissed hugely in a steaming flow, with dignity and nonchalance, eyes firmly latched on Elphaba. Through the Rafiki, the elephant then said, "Daughter of the dragon, I too am under a spell. I know how it may be broken, but I choose to live as a changeling. An elephant is a hunted thing in these times. The Scrow approve of me. They have worshipped elephants from the time before language, the time before history began. They know I am not a goddess. They know I am a beast who chooses magical incarceration as a human over the dangerous liberty of my own powerful form. When the times are a crucible, when the air is full of crisis," she said, "those who are the most themselves are the victims." Elfie could only look. She could not speak. "But the choice to save yourself can itself be deadly,"
said the Princess Nastoya. Elfin nodded, looked away, looked back.
"I will give you 3 crows as your familiars," said the princess. "You are in hiding as a witch now. That is your guise." She spoke a word to the crows, and 3 mangy, evil-looking things came and waited nearby.
"A witch?" Elphaba said.
"What her father would think."
"Hiding from what?"
"We have the same enemy," replied the princess. "We are both at risk. If you need help, send the crows. If I am still alive, as an old matriarch monarch, or as a free elephant, I'll come to your aid."
"Why?" asked Elfie.
"Because no retreat from the world can mask what is in your face," she answered. The princess said more. It had been years, more than a decade, since Elfie had been able to talk to an animal. Who, Elfie asked the princess, had enchanted her? But the Princess Nastoya wouldn't say. In part as self-protection, for the death of the enchanter could sometimes mean the revocation of binding spells, and her curse was her safety.
"But is life worth living in the wrong form?" said Elfie.
"The interior doesn't change," she answered, "except by self-involvement, of which be not afraid, and also beware."
"I have no interior," said Elphaba.
"Something told those bees to kill the cook," said the Princess Nastoya, with a glitter in her eye. Elphaba felt herself go pale.
"I didn't," she said. "No, it couldn't have been me. And how do you know?"
"You did, on some level. You are a strong woman. And I can hear bees, you know. My ears are keen."
"I would like to stay here with you," said Elphaba. "Life has been very hard. If you can hear me when I cannot hear myself, something the superior monde could never do, you could help me do no harm in this world. That's all I want, to do no harm."
"By your own admission, you have a job to do," said the princess. She curled her trunk around Elphaba's face, feeling its contours and truths. "Go and do it."
"May I return to you?" asked Elfie. But the princess wouldn't answer. She was tiring. She was an old, old thing, even for an elephant. Her trunk went back and forth like a pendulum on a clock. Then the great nose hand came forward and set itself with wonderful weight and precision on Elphaba's shoulders and curled a bit around her neck.
"Listen to me, sister," she said. "Remember this. Nothing is written in the stars. Not these stars nor any others. No one controls your destiny."
Elphaba could not answer, so shocked was she at the touch. She backed away when dismissed, her mind all but out of her. Then the return on camels across the shuddering colors of night grass, hypnotic, vague, and distressing. Yet there was blessing in this night. Elphaba had forgotten blessing, too, like so much else. They left the Skrow encampment and the Princess Nastoya behind. The grass trail train moved in a circle north now, a wide arch. Igo died and was buried in a sandy mound. "Give his spirit movement and flight," said Elfie at the ceremony. The Rafiki admitted later that he had thought one of the guests of the command meeting with the Princess Nastoya was to be sacrificed in a ritual slaughter. It had happened before. The princess, though coping with her dilemma, was not above a sense of revenge. It was the honesty of Pinchweed that saved him, as he was the obvious choice. Or perhaps Igo wore the prospect of his death closer to the surface than humans could see, and the elephant took pity. The crows were annoying. They pestered the bees, shat all over the wagon, teased Killyjoy. The Glicken, Rerenee, stopped at a well, met her isolated widower husband-to-be, and left the grass-trail train. The toothless new husband already had 6 motherless children, and they took to Rerenee like orphan ducklings behind a farm dog. There were only 10 travelers left.
"Now we're entering Arjiki tribal lands," said the Rafiki.
The first Arjiki band approached a few days later. They wore nothing so splendid as what Fiyero had worn, in the way of blue markings. These were nomads, shepherds, rounding up the sheep from the western foothills of the Great Kells for their annual counting, and, it seemed, sail to the east. Still, just the handsome look of them ripped Elfie's heart into pieces. Their wildness, their otherness. "This may be a punishment to the hour of my death," she thought. The grass trail train by now was down to only 2 wagons. In one, the Rafiki, Otzi, Lear the boy, Pinchweed the entrepreneur, and a Gilliconese mechanic named Kaup. In the other, Elfie herself and the bees, the crows, and Killyjoy. Already she had, it seemed, been accepted as a witch. It was not an entirely unlikable disguise. Kiamo Ko was just a week away. The grass trail train turned eastward into the steel-gray passes of the steep Great Kells. Winter was almost here, and the last travelers were grateful that the snows had held off. Otzi intended to stop the winter in an Arjiki camp some 20 miles on. In the spring, she would head back to the Emerald City, making the northern route through Ugabu and the Pertha Hills of Gilliken. Elfie thought of sending a note to Glinda, if, after all these years, she was still there. But being unable to decide yes, she decided no.
"Tomorrow," said Otzi, "we'll see Kiamo Ko, the mountain stronghold of the ruling clan of the Arjikis. Are you ready, Sister Elfie?"
She was teasing, and Elfie didn't like it.
"I am no longer a sister, I am a witch," she said, and tried to think poisonous thoughts at Otzi.
But Otzi was a stronger person than the cook, apparently, for she just laughed and went on her way. The grass trail train stopped on the side of a small tarn. The others said its water was refreshing, though icy cold. Elfie didn't know or care about that. But in the middle was an island, a tiny thing the size of a mattress, sprouting one leafless tree like an umbrella that has lost its fabric. Before Elphaba could quite make it out, the evening light came early at this time of year, and even earlier in the mountains. Killyjoy had plunged feverishly into the water, and splashed and swum his way to the island, intent on some small movement or interesting scent he had picked up. He ferreted in the sedge, and then clamped his teeth, the most wolf-like of his features, gently around the skull of a small beast in the grass. Elfie couldn't see, but it looked like a baby. Otzi screamed. Lear quivered like a blob of jelly. Killyjoy released his grip, but only to get a further hold. He was drooling over the scalp of the thing he had caught. There was no way to get through the water. That would be death. But her feet went out anyway. They hit the water hard. The water hit hard back.
The water turned to ice as she ran, foot by foot of ice, under foot by foot of hurry. A silvering plate formed instantly, cantilevering forward, making a cold, safe bridge to the island. Where Killyjoy could be scolded, and the baby saved, though she hadn't dared hope she could be in time. She pried Killyjoy's jaws apart and scooped up the thing. It shivered in terror and the cold. Its bright black eyes were alert and watching, ready to upbraid or condemn or love, same as any capable adult thing. The others were surprised to see it, as surprised as they'd been to see the ice form, perhaps by some magic spell left on the tarn from some passing wizard or witch. It was a small monkey, of the variety called the snow monkey. A baby abandoned by its mother and its tribe, or maybe separated by accident. It didn't think much of Killyjoy, but it liked the warmth of the wagon. They pitched their camp halfway up the perilous slope to Kiamo Cove. The castle rose in steep black angles out of black rock. Elfie could see it perched above them, like an eagle with folded wings. Its conical-roofed towers, its battlements and bartizans, its portcullis and arrow-slit windows, they all belied its original intention as the head of a waterworks. Below it wound a powerful tributary of the Vincus River, on which the Ozma Regent once had meant to build a dam and channel water into the center of Oz, back when the droughts were their most threatening. Fiero's father had taken this stronghold by siege and storm, and made it the seat of the Arjiki princes before dying and leaving the clan leadership to his only son, if Elphaba remembered rightly. The small luggage was packed, the bees hummed, their melodies ever more amusing as she listened week by week. Killyjoy was still sulking over being denied the kill. The crows sensed that a change was coming and wouldn't eat dinner. The monkey, who was called Chistery because of the sound he made, chittered and chattered now that he was warm and safe. Around the campfire, goodbyes were spoken, a few toasts, even a few regrets. The sky was blacker than it had been before. Perhaps it was the contrast of the whiteness of snowy peaks all around. Lear showed up with a parcel of clothing and some sort of musical instrument and said goodbyes, too. "Oh, so you're stopping here, are you?" said Elfie. "Yes," he said, "with you." "With the crows, the monkey, with the bees, with the dog, and with the witch," she said, "with me." "Where else can I go?" he asked. "I'm sure I don't know," she answered. "I can take care of the dog," he said calmly. "I can collect the honey for you." "It makes no difference to me," she said. "All right," he said, and so Lear prepared to enter his father's house. The Jasper Gates of Kiamo Cove. "Sarima," said her youngest sister, "wake up, nap time's over. We have a house guest at supper, and I need to know if we have to kill a hen. There are so few left, and what we give the traveler we miss all winter in eggs. What do you think?" The Dowager Princess of the Arjikis groaned. "Details, details," she said. "Can't I train you to figure out anything for yourself?" "Very well," snapped the sister. "I shall decide, and then you can go without your morning egg when we're one short." "Oh, Six, don't mind me," said Sarima. "It's just that I'm scarcely awake. Who is it? Some patriarch with bad breath who plans to bore us with tales of the hunting he did 50 years ago? Why do we allow it?" "It's a woman, more or less," said Six. "Now that's uncalled for," said Sarima, sitting up. We are none of us the blushing nymphs we once were, Six. From across the room she saw herself reflected in the wardrobe glass, pale as milk pudding, her still pretty face nestled in the puddles of fat that fell according to the laws of gravity. Just because you're the youngest, Six, and can still locate your waist, there's no need to be unkind. Six pouted.
Well, it's just a woman, then, so chicken or no. Tell me now, so Four can hack off its head and get to plucking, or we won't eat before midnight.
We'll have fruit and cheese and bread and fish. Is there fish in the fish well, I suppose?
Yes, there was. Six turned to go, but remembered to say, I brought you a glass of sweet tea. It's there on your vanity.
Bless you. Now tell me, without sarcasm, if you please, what's our guest like, really?
Green as sin, thin and crooked, older than any of us, dressed in black like an old Mont, but not all that old. I guess about, 30, 32. She wouldn't give her name.
Green? How divine, said Sarima.
Divine isn't the word that comes to mind, said Six.
You don't mean green with jealousy. You mean actually green?
Maybe it's from jealousy. I could not say. But she is surely green. Genuine grass green.
Oh, la. Well, I'll wear white tonight so as not to clash. Is she alone?
She came in with the caravan we saw down in the valley yesterday. She stopped here with a little company of beasts, a wolf dog, a hive of bees, a youth, some crows, and a baby monkey.
What'll she do with all of them in the mountains in winter?
Ask her yourself. Six wrinkled her nose. She made me shudder.
Half-set gelatin makes you shudder.
When's dinner tonight?
7 chimes and a half. She turns my stomach.
Six left, having run out of expressions of disgust, and Sarima had her tea in bed until her bladder complained. Six had banked up the fire and drawn the curtains, but Sarima pulled them back to look down into the courtyard. Kiamo Ko boasted corner turrets and towers, built on massive circular salients thrusting upward from the stone of the mountain itself. After the Arjiki clan had wrested the building from the Waterworks Commission, they had added toothy crenellations for defense. Despite the reworkings, the plan of the house was still simple. It was built in the general shape of a U, a central hall with 2 long narrow wings thrusting forward around a steeply pitched yard. When it rained, the water churned over the cobbles and slipped out under the carved gates of iron oak and jasper panels, past the sickly cluster of village houses nestled up against the castle's outside walls. At this hour, the courtyard was charcoal gray. Cold and filthy, with scraps of hay and bits of leaf flying in the wind. There was a light in the old cobbler's shed, and smoke spinning from the chimney that badly wanted repointing, like everything else in this decaying manse. Sarima was glad the guest hadn't been shown into the house proper. As Dowager Princess of the Arjikis, she enjoyed the privilege of welcoming a traveller into the private chambers of Kiamo Ko. After bathing, she dressed in a white shift with white piping and put on the beautiful torque that had arrived like a message from the other land from her dear departed husband several months after the incident. Out of habit, Sarima shed a few tears, admiring herself within the flat embrace of its jeweled, segmented collar. If it was too dressy for this itinerant, Sarima could always drape a napkin over it. But she would still know it was there. Even before her tears had dried, she was humming, looking forward to the novelty of a guest.
She peeped in on the children before going down. They were jumpy. Strangers always did that to them. Irgi and Manik, 12 and 11, were almost old enough to want to bust out of this nest of venomous doves. Irgi was soft and cried a lot, but Manik was a little bantam. Always had been. If she let them go off to the grasslands with the clan in the summer migration, they both might have their throats slit. There were too many clansmen to claim leadership for themselves or their sons, so Sarima had kept her boys near. Her daughter, Noor, long-legged and thumb-sucking at 9 years old, still needed a lap to crawl into before going to sleep. Dressed for the meal, Sarima was inclined to forbid it, but relented. Noor had a delicate lisp, and she said, "Wanning in the wane," for running in the rain. She befriended stones and candles and blades of grass that grew against all logic in the cracks of the coping stones around the windows. She sighed and rubbed her face against the torque and said, "There's a boy, too, Mama. We played with him in the mill yard." "What's he like? Is he green, too?"
"Nah, he's all right. He's a big baby, fat and strong, and Manik was throwing stones at him to see how far they would bounce off him. He let him do it. Maybe if you're so fat it doesn't hurt."
"I doubt it. What's his name?"
"Weir. Isn't that a queer name?"
"It sounds foreign. And his mother?"
"I don't know her name, and I don't think she's his mother. He wouldn't say when we asked. Irgi said he must be a bastard. Weir said he didn't care. He's nice."
She moved her right thumb to her mouth and with her left hand felt the cloth of Sarima's gown just below the torque until she found a nipple, and she ran her thumb over it lovingly as if it were a small pet.
"Manik made him pull down his trousers, so we could make sure his thing wasn't green."
Sarima disapproved, on the grounds of hospitality, if nothing else, but was compelled to ask, "And what did you see?"
"Oh, well, you know."
Noor turned her head into her mother's neck, and then sneezed from the powder with which Sarima kept her chins from chafing.
"Stupid-looking boy's thing. Smaller than Manik and Irgi, but not green. I was so bored, I didn't look much."
"Neither would I. That was very rude."
"I didn't make him do it. Manik did."
"Well, no more of that. Now let's have a story before sleeping. I've got to go down soon, so a short one. What do you want to hear, my little one?"
"I want to hear the story of the witch and the fox babies."
With less drama than usual, Sarima rattled through the tale of how the three fox babies were kidnapped and caged and fed to fatness in preparation for a cheese and foxling casserole, and how the witch went to get fire from the sun to cook them. But when the witch came back to her cave, exhausted and in possession of Father Flame, the foxlings outwitted her by singing a lullaby to make her sleep. When the witch's arm fell, the flame from the sun burned the door off the cage, and out the foxlings ran. Then they howled down Old Mother Moon to come and stand as an unmovable door in the entrance of the cave. Sarima ended with the traditional back and forth. And there the wicked old witch stayed for a good long time.
"Did she ever come out?"
asked Noor, doing her line from an almost hypnagogic state.
"Not yet,"
said Sarima, kissing and biting her daughter on the wrist, which made them both giggle. And then lights out. The stairs from Sarima's private apartment ran without railings down into the castle keep, hugging first one wall,
and then, after the corner, another. She descended the first flight, full of grace and self-possession, her white skirts billowing, her torque a yoke of soft colors and precious metal.